I was a kid in the 80s, and I remember the satanic panic and other related rumors that were circulating then. Rumors about children getting kidnapped or disappearing, blonde-haired, blue-eyed children mainly. Rumors that spread across North America like wildfire about an elite organization of Satan worshippers who operated in a cell-like system and preyed upon children. Rumors that were disseminated by the mass media.
6 clues that point to the illegal worship of Satan.
Rumors that tapped into deeper anxieties about family roles and bonds, and about economic problems, about the moral decay of America. I'm not American. I'm from the west coast of Canada, where I produce this podcast out of studios in Victoria, BC. But this city can be seen as ground zero for some of the rumors that impacted lives during the 1980s, when people were scared about Satanists stealing, abusing, and sacrificing their children. Because some of those rumors were simmering here since 1970, and those rumors have given Victoria the unlikely title of the witchcraft, or Satanist capital, depending who you ask, of North America. Welcome to Sleepy City, a podcast about microcultures in Victoria. Today we're talking about the Satanic Panic and its deep roots in Victoria. We'll hear from two men who were directly affected by the rumors in what they see as a literal modern-day witch hunt. And for one of them at least, the impact of those rumors continues still. We'll also hear from someone who didn't take the rumors that seriously. One Victoria site in particular has a reputation in the heavy metal scene as a dark, evil place. Ross Bay Cemetery. It's named after Isabella Mainville Ross, who owned the land in the 1850s. Isabella is a unique figure in Victoria history because not only was she the first woman to be registered as a landowner in British Columbia, she was also an Anishinaabe and French Métis Indigenous woman. The city purchased the land from her in 1872, and she's buried there along with other Victoria notables. But the well-maintained Oceanside Cemetery has a creepy reputation beyond the usual Victoria ghost stories.
We'd have a storm and, bodies would wash away. And I don't know how true those stories are, but, they're almost legendary, and even back then, back in the day, Ross Bay Cemetery was a very well-known place. And absolutely, we used to go party in there. And I remember I had a friend that was a girl show up from Alberta who was really into metal. She was a lot more into the dark side of metal than I was and probably took it a little more seriously than I did. But I remember us walking through Ross Bay Cemetery and we found like a bush that was cut in the shape of a chair. It was like it was cut there so some high priest could sit in this chair. And, your imagination would run wild with you when you'd go through the cemetery and see these things, right? See odd things and whatnot.
This is Rick Lee, a member of the band Armoros.
Played bass and vocals for Armoros, yeah.
They played thrash metal in Victoria in the 80s. They've got a song called Remember Michelle, which is a reference to a book that pushed the satanic cult rumors over the top in Victoria.
I read it with a pretty open mind. I didn't read it thinking I was going to write a song about it. I just read it, for the story, because it seemed like an interesting story. It was local, and it seemed, in the realm of, sort of things we were into at the time. But I remember wanting to believe it, wanting to believe her recollections, but at the same time, a lot of the stories were really unbelievable. So you're kind of wondering, it leaves you wondering, are these real memories or are these just, hallucinations or false memories, or is it blatant lies? Or, I do remember reading the book being kind of really baffled by how much of it to believe and how much of it not to believe. It really gives you that sense of, is this real?
Michelle, don't tell, are you welcome?
Michelle Remembers was published in 1980. It's co-written by Michelle Smith and her psychiatrist, Lawrence Pazder, and it's a big part of this Victoria story.
And it's just something I happened across, and it probably intrigued me because it was about Victoria. It's probably what really piqued my interest. It wasn't necessarily about the Satan part of it. It was a story about Victoria and, you know, what could go on. Because, you know, at the time when you're kids, you're hanging out in Ross Bay Cemetery, drinking beer and stuff. So there's that whole macabre sort of thing going on. So you're very interested in those kind of dark things. You know, once I stumbled upon the book, it made me want to read it, you know.
The book was sold as a nonfiction account of Michelle's childhood that she told to Lawrence Pazder when he helped her recover memories during therapy sessions in the 1970s. This kind of recovered memory therapy is not well regarded in Canada, the US, or Britain anymore, but it was a big deal in the 80s. In the book, Michelle says her mother gave her to a group of devil worshippers who then kept her captive and abused her for an 8-month-long Feast of the Beast ceremony in 1955, when she was 5 years old. Michelle's tale is lurid.
It's been a long, long time, but I remember stuff like, you know, sewing horns and a tail on her. And I remember stuff like, you know, it's even in the lyrics of the song about being in this, put in this statue of Satan and looking through the eyes and having all the people dancing around the fire and stuff and seeing the image of Satan in the fire. And so, you know, it definitely left a very lasting impression on me. I do remember a lot of the bits of the story. I've read books that I can't tell you today, you know, what's in them. But that one I remember, I definitely remember certain parts of it. Mm-hmm. Probably helps that I wrote lyrics about it, so I have a frame of reference.
For Rick and Armaros, the book and its subject matter were something they could tap into.
There were a few people that would, like I was telling you about that girl from Alberta, she was very much into it. And it kind of freaked me out a little bit. You know, I remember we're in the cemetery and she starts talking, you know, in tongues or whatever, in this weird sort of language stuff. And it really weirded me out. You know, there were people back then that took it very, very seriously, you know, kind of taken by it. But none of my friends did, you know. We were never really that into it, you know. It was a stylistic thing to us, you know, like a subject matter. You're playing dark music, so you want dark lyrics, and you can get a lot of dark imagery from that sort of thing. But we also wrote songs about all sorts of stuff.
So for some, like Rick, Michelle Remembers was not to be taken too seriously. But for many others, a surprising number, that book was proof of a high-level conspiracy of secretive devil worshippers who preyed on children. And that belief fueled a continent-wide panic.
You know, the very first interview I ever did on television was for a local television station here.
This is Kirk Uhulain, an author and a former police officer. He was also the first openly Wiccan cop in the Vancouver Police Force. He began his career in 1977.
And they had sort of buzzed out my face, so you can see it, and changed my voice a little bit. And I'm wearing a Wiccan t-shirt, and they're asking me stuff. And I had just enough time to leave the studio, race to the police station, and sneak into the detective's lounge just as we're starting to sit down to lunch. And they're watching the news, and that story came up. And suddenly everything got very quiet, and I'm holding my breath, like, what's going to happen? And then somebody goes, oh, how about that? Oh, you know? They didn't figure out right away who it was who had done it. I mean, it took them probably a couple of weeks before they said, well, it had to be, you know, him. And people started asking. But, you know, it was gradually, you know, working up in stages. When the police department finally threw in the towel and said, okay, we're not doing this anymore, it was hysterically, this inspector, who is like a real assertive, go-get-him, former emergency response field commander kind of a guy, calls me and says, obviously nervous, can you come and, you know, I want to talk to you about an audit, and we'll get together in the coffee shop. And think, coffee shop? What the heck? You know, so I go and meet him. And by this time, I figured out what it's probably going to be. And he sits down. He's all nervous. I'm not sure where to start. And grabs a napkin, scribbles something on it, flips it over, slides it across the table, and I flip it over, and it says Wicca. And I went, yeah, I know what that is. Is that what's bothering you? And they finally go, yeah, okay, we're going to stop doing this? Well, it just gives you an indication of how uncomfortable they were, you know, and what they thought, you know, was going to happen if I complained about me finding out about the investigations.
In 1995, after Cahulain left the Vancouver Police Department, he made a Freedom of Information request for all the investigations into him that were carried out while he was a cop. He'd known about them while he was still working as a police officer.
The people who were doing the surveillance were quite talented people who I ought not to have seen, but I was seeing them, and it was pretty clear they were doing it deliberately because they wanted me to know, because they weren't happy about being asked to do this. So I did this request and ended up with a pile of paper, literally hip high, six investigations, each of them started by a different inspector who wanted to be the one that finally proved that this guy is a satanic cult member, because they'd read about all this stuff, like Michel remembers stuff that was connected to it. And every single one of them went to the legal department, and the first one came back with a memo that said, A, this is a legal religion, B, leave him alone. And number two through number six, the memos that came back said, A, this is still a legal religion, B, why are we doing this again, you know? And that's extremely frustrating.
In some cases, the investigations were sparked by incredibly feeble accusations.
I went to a Christmas party. I was in the gang crime unit then, and one of the people in the squad, knowing I was Wiccan, said, hey, do you do tarot cards? And I went, yeah, so would you bring them and read them for me? Sure. So I ended up reading for half the squad while I was there, you know, we're having a good time. And 2 days later, the sergeant whose place we had this at had a cat, and it died. And he wrote to the inspector in charge of the internal investigation unit and said, well, we all know he's a Satanist, and my cat died. I wonder if there's a connection. The next thing you know, they're going off to the SPCA to see if cats are missing, because I was a volunteer SPCA inspector in Squamish then, too, and of course there weren't. And you read this, and you don't know whether to cry or what. I mean, like, are you serious? Really?
Did you hear him reference Michel Remembers? Teenagers in the Victoria metal scene might not have taken the book very seriously, but that was not the case for many others who bought into widespread panic in the 1980s about satanic cults operating in North America. And here's where I'll give my subjective review of Michel Remembers. It's total garbage. It's written badly, and not in a way that's fun to read. Michel details disgusting things that were allegedly done to her, and it's co-written by Michel and her psychiatrist, which makes point of view and narrative voice incredibly confusing. I'll mention here that the two of them left their spouses and eventually married each other, which gives their whole doctor-patient relationship a very uncomfortable quality. The main problem, though, with Michel Remembers is that there is no evidence. In fact, in absence of supporting evidence for Michel, there's a lot of tangible evidence against her tale, like her school records that don't show an 8-month-long absence, or photographs of her when she was allegedly a captive of the satanic cult. The book has been discredited by several people, including Kerr Cahulain, who investigated. He was a cop, after all. There's a staged accident where Michel is left to die in a vehicle with a day-old corpse. In the book, no law enforcement, firefighters, or coroner on the scene find the staged accident strange.
I can't think of any, you know, basic law enforcement training would be enough for someone to go there and take a look at that and say, yeah, that's not right. You know, it really is a no-brainer. You wouldn't have to be an expert, a coroner or something to figure that out. It's just, but, you know, they're constantly saying, oh, well, the records were all destroyed. Yeah, not quite. They didn't destroy the newspaper records. And there's no record of an accident of that sort, and there would have been something that serious.
As Rick mentioned earlier, she also claimed to have been kept inside a giant statue of the devil that had holes for eyes so she could look out at the ongoing ceremonies.
The size of the place that they must have had to do the, you know, to have that many people in there with this enormous hollow statue with her sitting on a ladder inside of it.
The Virgin Mary makes an appearance, giving Michel a pep talk in French at one point. The devil also has a couple of big scenes in which he speaks in rhyming verse. Bad rhyming verse. During his investigation, Cahulain didn't meet with the pastors.
I met family members. I met, you know, an ex-wife, you know, this kind of thing. I tried, but they didn't. They wouldn't. Well, I mean, they were quite mystified. They were quite upset because, I mean, basically, Lawrence, you know, leaves his wife and marries his patient. And when they went to the Vatican to have that audience, I mean, I've got the receipt still in the file here that I got from his ex, showing that he was getting hotel rooms for him and Mrs. Pastor, and this is Michelle that he's with, not his wife, and she didn't even know where he was. I mean, people in the family were not very happy about that, as you can well imagine, you know? They were being lied to about that.
When the book came out, the truth of Michelle's claims went widely unquestioned. The following year, Lawrence Pazder coined the term ritual abuse in a paper he presented to the American Psychiatric Association's annual general meeting. According to journalist Debbie Nathan, by 1987, Pazder claimed he was spending a third of his time consulting on ritual abuse cases. Quotes from the book were even included in FBI training materials. Nathan discredited Michelle Remembers in her book called Satan's Silence, Ritual Abuse and the Making of a Modern American Witch Hunt. She documents Michelle's story as one of the early examples of false memory syndrome, which is the phenomenon of recovered memories of ritual abuse, which was a key component of the satanic panic. If you're unfamiliar, basically it involves psychiatric patients remembering abuse, often sexual. The memories emerge during therapy and often involve satanic rituals. I'm not going to talk about that so much in this episode, but I'll post a link on the website to an episode of This American Life that features a story told by a woman who recovered memories of ritual abuse, which she later realized were false. This is a hugely problematic aspect of the satanic cult rumor panic. For one, you've got people making false claims of abuse and the accused feeling real repercussions because of that. But then there are actual abuse victims whose experiences can be ignored or minimized because of these allegations. And so, in the late 80s, allegations were flying. People were going to court over satanic cult rumors.
For nationwide, police are hearing strikingly similar horror stories, and not one has ever been proved.
Calling this a modern-day witch hunt is not an exaggeration. Several times the people I interviewed alluded back to Salem, Massachusetts in the 1690s.
I teach the history of the Salem witch trials periodically, both in early America courses, in my history of women class, and in my history of sexuality classes.
This is Rachel Cleaves, a history professor at the University of Victoria.
And I find that most of my students, even though they're Canadian, are familiar with the history of Salem, and many of them have either read or watched Arthur Miller's famous play, The Crucible.
Anyone breathe a word, and I will come to you in the black of some terrible night, and I will bring with me a pointy reckoning that will shudder you.
I saw Bridget Bishop with the devil.
So the story of Salem and the Salem witch trials had a lot of currency in American culture prior to the 1950s, but I think that the ways in which we remember Salem now are heavily influenced by Miller's metaphor of the Salem witch trials, or use of the Salem witch trials as a metaphor for, or an allegory for, the McCarthyist persecution of leftists during the Cold War.
She explains what happened in Salem.
The episode did begin with the illness of a particular young girl who was in the household of a minister in Salem, a guy named Reverend Samuel Parris. There were a sequence of events, but this young woman's sickness was attributed to the effects of witchcraft. And there were sort of spiraling accusations made initially by young women in the community against older women in the community. But very quickly, those accusations spiraled outwards, both in terms of who was making accusations and who came to be accused. And by the time that the special court that had been convened to hear these accusations was terminated, they spiraled outwards to encompass people in significant positions of power. So the initial targets were women, and they were women who were suspect for one reason or another, because they were poor, because they were outsiders, because they had questionable sexual reputations for various reasons. But eventually, these accusations encompassed men as well as women and people in positions of power. And I started digging, actually, provoked by your question, into when the words witch trial were first used to connote that sort of persecution. And it seems to me, actually, that it might originate a little bit earlier in the century, in the 20s and in the, or 1919, and in the Red Scare in the United States immediately after the Bolshevik Revolution that created the Soviet Union. So I think the ways in which we talk about witch trials now are highly influenced by anti-communist politics in the United States in the 20th century. At least that's it seems from my discussions with my students. But it's interesting to think about how these people who've experienced this, you know, persecution, either through the panic over Satanism within Victoria, identify with the victims of the Salem witch trials, and maybe they're finding some point of connection which runs deeper than that 20th century anti-communist overlay.
Cleave says she finds the trials interesting from the perspective of religious history.
For what they reveal about how people at the time thought about the supernatural world and about the devil, because, of course, the devil is a really prominent figure in the Salem witchcraft trials. The understanding of witchcraft in the 17th century bears a lot of resemblances to how we think about Satanism maybe in the 21st century. So for people in the 1690s, witchcraft was understood as a relationship of subservience between an individual and the devil, right? So the power of witchcraft was the power given by the devil. This was often seen in like really sexualized terms, that women were entering into sexual relationships with the devil, more or less.
This idea of a devil as a supernatural being that could interact with people is part of the complicated atmosphere at the time that allowed the satanic cult rumors to gain traction.
I'm struck by how pervasive and consistent the belief of the people in at the time is in the operation of the devil in their daily life. So, everybody approaches those trials, almost everyone approaches those trials from the perspective that it is reasonable to imagine that an individual might consort with the devil and might, through consorting with the devil, gain supernatural powers over their neighbors and friends and enemies, etc. And when I think about that, it occurs to me that many people in the 17th century probably did understand themselves to be in relationships with the devil. Like, there probably were people who thought that they were witches or thought that they were wizards and thought that they had gained agency through the devil, because those were a reasonable set of beliefs at the time. I wonder about that, too, in terms of the 80s satanic panic, that on the one hand, we know that there was all this hysteria and that lives were ruined and people suffered because of accusations that had no grounding in reality. But at the same time, we know that there were people in the 1980s who did embrace Satanism, right? Who did think – so Satanism wasn't purely a fantasy of the paranoid and the delusional. It was also, in fact, an attractive set of beliefs for some people.
I wanted to talk to the authors about why they wrote the book. Why did Michelle make those claims? Dr. Pazder died in March 2004, and I was unable to find Michelle. I reached out to a family member of hers who didn't respond to me. There's a comment included at the beginning of the book by Remy DeRue, who was the bishop of the Catholic Diocese of Victoria at the time. It's dated September 28, 1977, so nearly 3 years before the book was published. It's vague in its actual support, but DeRue says, quote, "I do not question that for Michelle this experience was real," end quote. In 1990, Pazder appears to backtrack about the book's contents when he is quoted in a British newspaper saying it was more important that Michelle thought the events were true than the events actually being true, which is maybe all the insight we'll get into the motivations for the book. That and the attention and money the two received as expert witnesses when they testified at trials of ritual abuse cases or attended speaking engagements in the United States at the height of the panic. It was part of a circuit of law enforcement and religious education seminars and conferences.
These people would be paraded out to present this stuff, to try to convince other law enforcement officers that this was a major problem, to go out and fight this satanic conspiracy. And I can remember some of these guys. I mean, I went to a lot of these conferences and listened to them, and I remember going to, one of them, officer out of Chicago. And you, as the years go on, you go and say, you know what? You keep changing your story to try to get around the fact that you still haven't found any evidence. When are you going to finally, you know, figure out that you're wasting your time here? But, you know, they're just absolutely obsessed with this, some of these people. They can't let go. It's part of their beliefs and you know, their paranoia, and they are doing everything they can to try and cling to it. But if they're using a position of authority, or misusing, I should say, a position of authority like that, that's, you know, a serious problem.
A speaking tour that Cahoon Lane actively tried to combat by doing his own speaking engagements in communities in the States.
There was a group of about a dozen people trying to form a Wiccan church in the West Memphis area, and they'd actually opened a bookstore, an occult bookstore, New Age bookstore, in Jonesboro, which is, quite frankly, not the best business plan, because this place is locally referred to as Fort God, and I'm not sure who they'd have sold books to. They opened the store, and then 3 days later, the landlord figured out who they were and said they're Satanists and closed the store. So they had a little protest march down to City Hall, about 20 of them with their signs, and 700 Screaming Fundamentalist Christians were bussed in to try to form them, and it took 7 police jurisdictions brought in from all over to try and keep them apart. And so people were really concerned that this was going to turn into a mess, and I went down and spoke in Little Rock, you know. I went and spoke in Jonesboro in body armor with 2 bodyguards in the entire Jonesboro Police Department in the front row, and there was like 3 venues that they'd tried to run this at before they finally found one where they were willing to do it because they were afraid of what the consequences would be. Then I go down the road to the University of Memphis Faculty of Psychology with 300 people, and it's completely opposite. It's entirely civilized, you know, because they're used to people who are different, where in a small town they're not. And then I went, you know, and spoke to the Memphis Police Academy. And that morning I was having breakfast just before I went there. And one of the young people at the table was an 18-year-old, Charles Taylor. And he said, I want to be a cop, but I'm afraid I'm not going to make it because I'm Wiccan. And look at what's going on. And I said, you know what, you're going to take these papers into the training sergeant. You're going to put them in front of them, say, this is a legal religion. Here's the information. These are the contacts. If you have questions, this isn't an issue. Let's talk about my job. Well, 5 years later, he called me out of the blue. Said, hey, do you remember me? Yes, I do. And he was a training sergeant. Well, 2012, I get invited back to Memphis, and those 12 people had turned into 250 people and 8 established Korean Tabernacle Church organizations, 3 generations. And the guy that picked me up at the airport is Captain Charles Taylor, who is now the chief of the Burlington Railway Police, and, you know, quite open about his beliefs. So things have changed.
In the end, he says he feels like being open about his own beliefs helped make it easier for others who were seen as outsiders in what was a predominantly white, heterosexual, male professional field.
Every time I went and spoke to the press about one of these things, I had this parade of officers who were gay or Jewish or Sikh or whatever saying, yeah, good for you. Because they all had the same kind of problems in one way or another as minorities, you know? And so they kind of viewed me as speaking for everybody. And I guess in a sense I was. But by the time I left, there were more than one officer in the department that were pagan. There was, you know, officers who were openly gay. There was one that had a sex change, you know. And people were starting getting used to the idea that difference, okay. You know, we're not all white. It's not necessary for us all to be that way. So, I mean, the culture gradually changed. And so it was quite a different organization when I left it compared to when I entered it.
One person in particular in Victoria felt the impact of satanic cult rumors.
My bookstore, of course, was eventually closed because I had fundamentalist Christians trying to stop people from coming in the shop and speaking in tongues and preaching. I had had teeth knocked out, nose broken, you know, and I had all kinds of things happen to me as a result of that. I had all kinds of persecution from police officers. I had all kinds of things that were going on that were, you know, really incredibly taxing. I was having a hard time getting work. This urban legend just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
This is Lion's Son.
And I'm a Gnostic bishop in the Holy Catholic Gnostic Church. I got burnt by the state, if you will.
A man named Len Olson accused Lyon's son of trying to kill him at a satanic ritual that happened in 1972. Olson and his wife were new to Victoria at the time and had been friendly with Sun. Olson made the allegations on a nationally syndicated TV show, 100 Huntley Street, a fundamentalist Christian talk show produced in Toronto.
Join me every day, right here on Channel 3 CKVR TV, for Canada's daily Christian television ministry.
Well, my daughter actually says to me, "Oh, Dad, I didn't know your hair was that long." And I went, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, you're on TV, Dad." And I came out, and there is a picture of me being held up. And, wow, I'm thinking, Jesus, this is outrageous. It was 100 Huntley Street. Yeah, and they were zeroing in with the camera, like a person would with a scope on a gun on a deer. And they're saying, yes, this is the man. This is the man who attempted to murder Reverend Olson and his wife to Satan. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. God, tell me this isn't happening.
Lyon's son says Olson had made the allegations before with a pamphlet he'd circulated locally called Set Free, but the national TV coverage resulted in legal action. Son says he had read about Satanism and at one point spoken to Anton LaVey, but was ultimately not interested in participating in the religion.
Basically, we were very eclectic in the sense that we were very interested in comparative religion, as we still are as Gnostics. What we do is we often take a little bit of the best from everything and then just kind of chuck the rest. So, you know, all the different systems that are out there, you know, we've looked into. And if we haven't and we hear about it, we do. We try to be very open-minded. I think perhaps because it was Wicca primarily, though, that I was practicing back then as a high priest, that some of the people in the Wicca community, and there weren't very many back then, we were pretty much it. But some of them knew deep down in our heart of hearts that, you know, we were definitely into Wicca and into the goddess, basically. That's, I think, what especially attracted me to it was the concept of a goddess. We were a little eclectic. Some people go, well, you know, how come you're singing Hare Krishna, or how come you're, you know, doing a Sioux lullaby? And, well, again, you know, we were kind of eclectic, but at the same time, the general consensus of it was Wicca.
He says there was a ritual that Len Olson and his wife took part in October 1972, but it was a Wiccan ritual. In court, he testified there'd been alcohol and marijuana at the ritual, and Olson had been smoking and got paranoid.
What we do is we'll draw up a circle, and we'll draw up a circle, like we'll take a broom and we'll sweep the circle of any negative energy. Then we'll draw it up with a sword. Then at the end of the ritual, we will often have athames.
That's a ceremonial knife.
And we'll cut the energy, right? So that any energy that may have been invoked in any way, you know, is dispersed. So we at some point wanted to break the circle. And what you do is you take the athame and you point it towards the center of the circle. Well, Leonard is not in the center of the circle. Leonard's back, but he, when we were lifting these, he starts freaking out again. And next thing I know, he's bolting out the door.
And the next day,
I have police officers everywhere. You know, I'm trying to be understanding, and I'm realizing at some point that he obviously got embarrassed and had freaked out. And
the legal action went on for a long time.
It went on for quite a few years, actually. A lot of people, I don't think they really realize just when something like that happens, how involved it is and all the things you have to go through for examinations, for discovery, and the documents that you have to acquire, and, you know, investigators and, you know, people like Christian Info were saying things like, you know, that my trial was being paid for by the taxpayers, and that basically, it, you know, that they were coming against these poor Christians, and that, you know, if I ever did succeed in my lawsuit, how many other people would be, you know, drawn into this? And, you know, it was absolutely incredible. And the thing is I wasn't getting any money from taxpayers. Mm-hmm. This is all money that I had to come up with. And at the end of the day, of course, when the jury, and the jury was, as far as I'm concerned, I think the jury was fair, but it took us 7.5 weeks in the Supreme Court of Canada. Mm-hmm. They wanted to know everything about me, what my tattoos meant, you know, my name, I was basically, even though I was the plaintiff, was the one on trial.
In the end, the jury found that Sun did not try to kill Lynn Olson at any kind of ritual, but that it was reasonable to believe he was a Satanist at the time. The jury awarded him $10,000 damages, but he was ordered to pay half the costs, which outweighed the award. And being branded a Satanist has affected him to this day.
Well, there's smoke, there's fire. Obviously, you know, there's something going on here. And it was absolutely incredible. I mean, I even had officers from CSIS tapping my phone and monitoring everything I did, and every chance they could, rattling my cage. And the persecution was unbelievable.
How do you know they tapped your phone?
I know because of my investigators, and because one of the officers at some point after years of this said that he was tired of listening to conversations between me and my daughter, and he felt totally horrible about the fact that this was still going on.
2 days before I finished this episode, he called me to tell me that this year someone in his building threw urine on him and accused him of killing a young boy who disappeared in the 1980s in a very high-profile case. He believes the accusations against him have allowed people to use him as a scapegoat.
When Michelle Smith's book came out in 1980, according to Special Agent Lanning of Behavioral Psychology of the FBI, he said that that book, when it came out, was as detrimental as the Malus Maleficarum, the witch's hamper, that these two Dominican priests put out to cause this big witch hunt that caused women's in the thousands to be murdered and raped and executed. And that book, when it came out, went right across North America and created this incredible billion-dollar industry about satanic ritual abuse. And some of the things we were just talking about earlier are some of the things that gave birth to that. And you have to realize that came out in 1980. So here's all these people going on about how outrageous this is, and how could this all be happening, and how could they be getting away with this? But there's no proof. There's no proof. Well, people now are beginning to really realize, slowly but surely, how this urban legend got going. And it's good because it's important. Look how big it got. Look what happened. It went right across North America. And it started here on some level.
Written about these cases, I'll post links to the books and sites I consulted for my research. If you're interested in the metal scene in the 80s in Victoria, Armorosa's unreleased album is finally being released by High Roller Records. I'll post a link to that as well on the site. That's all for Sleepy City this time. I'm Liz MacArthur. I produce, edit, and host the show. The website is sleepycitypodcast.com. Next time on Sleepy City. In 2 weeks, I'll be back with the strange case of Brother 12, a theosophist who headed up a colony of followers in Cedar, just south of Nanaimo. His story is a controversial one. What really happened at the colony? Where's the gold buried? Was he a mystic or a con man? Find out in 2 weeks.